I'm Ken Yeager. It's nice to be here. Thank you very much for coming. In the spirit of being Unitarians and part of the people I'm going to talk about, let me tell you about me. I was born in a Southern Baptist family in Missouri in a rural area. And if you know much about those folks, there's not room for dissent. You believe, you know, you get saved and you do all the stuff you're supposed to do. And I did. And I lived in my little closet, if you will, emotionally for a long time. Got out of college and moved away from the sight line of my parents and became a Presbyterian and was reasonably happy as a Presbyterian for about 50 years, I suppose. And a decade ago, literally this year, I was at a meeting with a guy and I found out that he was a Unitarian in Kansas City. I live up around St. Joseph, Missouri. And I asked him about the Unitarian Church and I visited All Souls the next Sunday. Liked what I heard. They started their new member class, as it turns out, the next Sunday, and I was there, went to all the new member classes, and signed their big book as soon as I could. And literally for the last 10 years of my life, I have been happy when it's Sunday morning. I used to dread Sunday mornings, and now I actually enjoy Sunday mornings, and I live 92 miles from the church. And it's a fun drive for an hour and a half to get to church. So anyway, I'll talk a little bit about a guy, John Sigmund, that we've already heard about a little bit. John Sigmund was a guy similar in that he was a Catholic originally, became a Lutheran, and then became a Calvinist. And you'll hear a little bit more about him. Let me tell you about Transylvania. I'm comfortable with this, and I think we need to know what Transylvania is, and I'll allude to this a little bit more a little bit later. If you go back to the World War I, there was the Austria-Hungarian Empire, which was quite large and covered lots of territory. Well, those folks were on the losing side of World War I, and so the victors, the Allies, did some dividing up of what was then Hungary. And they gave some of it to Poland. I think some of it went to Germany, and I'm not sure where all of it. But there was a big section, there was a big state, I'll call it, that's called Transylvania, that was part of Hungary. And they literally just said, okay, we're going to lop that off and move it legally to being Romania. It would be much like in Kansas. They said, all right, all of you that are north of Interstate 70 now belong to Nebraska. And that's what they did with a wave of the, oh, somebody likes that. Oops. Sorry about that. You owe me $5 later. So when you go to Romania, yes, the people are Romanian citizens that I know and that Ann has met and we visited with at our partner church. But they're all ethnic Hungarians, and the church service is conducted in Hungarian. The village where the church is located is all Hungarians, and I never appreciated what they were talking about on the news and so forth when they talked about ethnic cleansing. I didn't understand how people could be, from that standpoint, persecuted or kicked out of the country, whatever. And I don't see ethnic cleansing there, but I now understand a lot more about the ethnic aspect because the minister of the church, who will see his picture, neat young man, almost, I guess he's in his mid to late 30s, partly educated in the United States, speaks English well, understands a lot about American culture, but he is a Hungarian. He was born and raised in Romania. He's got a Romanian passport, but he is a Hungarian. And that is pretty typical of everybody that you're going to see or meet or get to know in Transylvania, because Transylvania is that state. And one of the maps, we've got some things out on the table, and one of the maps, if you look at it, it has about three languages there, and one of them is English, and it says Transylvania. And that is a highway road map of the Transylvania part of Romania. So if you go, you may wind up in Romania, but if you go to a partner church like ours, you will discover that you're among a bunch of Hungarians. So Transylvania is a real place. not necessarily part of my pitch, but there was a guy that became known as Dracula. And one of the places that Ann and I went was to the Braun Castle, which was Dracula's castle, and in Shigesora, which is a town closer to where our partner church is where Dracula was born. And we had coffee with the minister at the hotel where Dracula was supposedly born. So it's a fun, I think it's a fun place. I like new and different things. A teeny bit more about me, just to maybe explain it a little bit. I have a daughter, I have a son and a daughter, but my daughter and her husband are missionaries, Christian missionaries, work for the Evangelical Free Church in Iowa, basically. And they've been in the Prague vicinity. They live in a suburb of Prague. They've been there since 1993. And three of my five grandkids were born in the Czech Republic and have dual citizenship, and they're all fluent in Czech and English, and I love it. It's really great to be there and have one of my grandkids, when they were littler, with a Czech friend, and they talk to me in English and look at the buddy and speak to him in Czech for a while and then back to me, and it's really great. I got to know our partner church through Dick Dawson, who's the co-chair also of the Partner Church Council at All Souls. They have a connections meeting at the church every year where each organization has their little displays and talks about things. And Dick had found out that I had a daughter living in Europe and acquainted me with the Partner Church. And so I went there first in 2012. I started doing emails to the minister, and we traded emails, and I went there as an individual from my daughters in 2012 and 13. We had our first team go there in 2014. There were five of us, and then I have been there every year since then. And then this year we had four people were going to go, Ann, myself, and Dick and Ellie Dawson. And Dick's health failed him to some extent. He's recovering now, but they were not able to go. So Ann and I spent a little over a week there earlier this year. We were there from Saturday before Palm Sunday, so we attended church twice. I'll show you a little bit later at the end of my talks. I'll show you a bit of the service. I'm not the greatest photographer in the world. I'd set my camera up and let it run until the battery ran down. That was my plan. But you'll see how the women come in one door at the church and the men come in the other door. It's a very traditional kind of a place. Okay. We are here to some extent as Unitarians based on an event that happened in Romania. It happened in East Hungary. Because the eastern province of Hungary is Transylvania. And so this event that was alluded to in the reading, the Diet of Torda, that happened 451 years ago. That was when Queen Isabella had been the ruler of eastern Hungary province. Her son was John Sigismund, and he was the ruler at that time, and he was the individual that had been born a Catholic, became a Lutheran, became a Calvinist, and felt that you ought to be able to be free to believe in whatever you believed in relative to a supreme to a deity. The group that they call them were the anti-Trinitarians. They were the anti for the Trinity. They did not believe in the God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. And so they were the anti-Trinitarians. And one of the ministers, or maybe the minister, in John Sigismund's court was this guy Francis David. And Francis was the preacher who kept talking about you ought to be able to believe what you believe. You ought not to have the state confine your religious beliefs. If you go to Romania and go to Deva, the town of Deva, at the top of a steep hill, and I think it would be called a steep hill, not a mountain, but there is a citadel, a fortress up there, and that's where Francis David got himself committed to by virtue of his espousing this free religion kind of idea. And so Francis David was the first individual to die in prison as a result of wanting to be free to believe whatever he believed. But the Diet of Torta was the document that the ruling council passed, and that is the beginning, if you will, of the Unitarian Church in Eastern Hungary, which is now Transylvania, which is now Romania. Our church, All Souls, was 150 years old last year, and we thought that was a big deal, and it was for Americans. The Unitarians in Romania were celebrating 450 years because the Diet of Torta was in whatever 450 years is from last year. So we're here because of Francis David and John Sigismund. I'll show you, by the way, along with some of the slides, Queen Isabella and John Sigismund's grave, where they're buried. Okay. It might be dangerous to do this, but if I lose somebody, or if you want me to repeat, if you catch my eye with your hand, I'm willing to entertain other than Nebraska people who like my comments about Nebraska. Okay. Let me go back now to talk about, if you will, the beginning of the Partner Church program. Because the Unitarians in Transylvania, they are, from my perspective, and I say this politely, and I told you I had a daughter who is a Christian missionary, and I love her dearly. She's an amazing person. But she's known that her daddy doesn't believe that. She's known that since 1985 when she was in college. She and I had a trip together, and I figured it was time to come out of my atheist closet with my granddaughter. And so I did, and she loves me dearly still. Ceaușescu was the ruler, the dictator, in all of Romania up to, I think, for about 25 years. I don't know the exact beginning of his reign. I don't remember that. Might have it written down. Yeah, 67. Romania was in the Soviet Union orbit right after World War II. But the Soviets didn't come into Romania to control it. They didn't feel they needed to because Ceaușescu was a honorary enough dictator that the communists chose to leave him alone. And Romania was not a good place to live in that time period. If you go there today, you'll see some large rusted factories. And these factories were facilities operated by the government so they could have export. Ceaușescu wanted to make the country a big exporting powerhouse. And so he literally bled the country dry and was not a nice person. Not to belabor it, but the end of him came in December of 89. He was trying to raise wages at that last moment to placate people. Timișoara, I think, is the name of the place where there's a university. And you all being a university town, you're familiar with students and sometimes how they get things in their head. Well, the students there had started being very unhappy and demonstrating. And if you look it up on YouTube, you can see a video of Ceaușescu on one of the podiums talking to a big plaza of people. And you can tell the guy's under pressure because he's trying to raise wages for various trade groups and so forth. The next day is when the military come in with a helicopter, and they're flying him out of the country. And on the way, the pilot, because he was interviewed, and there's a YouTube video of that, the pilot convinced Ceaușescu and his wife, who was on board, and she was a good partner for him, evidently, from everything I've read. They were just not a nice couple at all. The pilot convinced him that we needed to land, that we were locked in on radar, and that they would probably shoot a missile at us, and, you know, we've got to land. And so there was an army base up here, and they landed, and that was almost the ending of Ceausescu. There was a short trial, and he and his wife were taken out back and executed that afternoon. And so that was the beginning. I mean, that was the end of Nicolae Ceausescu. That then opened the door, if you will, for the UU Church in the United States to start being interested in and started the Partner Church Program. So our Partner Church Program had its genesis when we could go, because before that you couldn't go into any communist countries. I've been a member of the Lions Club for a long time, and the Lions started expanding in Europe when the Soviet Union fell, because the Soviets wouldn't let Lions into those Soviet territories. Same thing with Ceausescu and Romania. The Partner Church's idea is to support individual and church congregation relationships between us in North America, United States and Canada, and congregations and orphanages and individuals in Romania. And there's different classes of membership. Individuals can be members of the Partner Church Association. Congregations can be members, and they make a gradient between large congregations and small. And you can either be a supporting congregation or just a member. So depending upon how much money a group might want to spend, a congregation want to spend, that program is alive and well. Currently, there are about 120 North American churches that have partner churches in Romania. If you look up the website, if you think about UUs, we're UUs, and Partner Church Council is just UUPCC. So if you look up UUPCC.org, you'll find the Partner Church website. And currently they're looking for, in Romania, in Transylvania, there's one church in there that would like a partner church here. And in Hungary, I think there are three Unitarian churches that would like partner churches here. I'll make a little bit of a pitch. I'm going to circle back to this later because I have some ideas that I'm going to just briefly expose to this group. Our church did its first visit in 1991. Ceausescu was deposed in 89, and in 91, the first All Souls... Excuse me. The first All Souls group went in 1991. I think it was about 15 people. I don't know the exact number. There was another group that went 3 years later. As a result of those visits, the church there and our church thought that a tractor would be a good purchase, and so a tractor was purchased and given to the church. I guess ultimately that didn't turn out to be too good of a thing. If you go to Romania, you'll see that it is a poor country. It is a very poor country. Nice people. The Romanian language is a Romance language, thank you. And my daughter lives in the Czech Republic, and I've been around Czechs, and I hope I don't offend anybody here. The Czechs are great people, but they're not overly friendly. And the Romanians are. They are friendly people. Don't know you, and yet they're much more open. And Anne thinks it's because of the Romance language connection. It's probably correct. I'm an engineer by education, so I don't know that much about languages. The other thing that happened from our church is that a retired minister and his wife, Litchfield, were there to Romania a couple times and liked it so well that they moved there. They immigrated there. Turned out he died not too terribly long after they got there. So, and I've not met her. Mrs. Litchfield still lives there and evidently likes it. We've had individuals from our congregation who have gone there on sort of a personal pilgrimage or mission trip. I mentioned earlier Dick and Ellie Dawson. Well, Ellie Dawson and another lady, Roxanne Jones, who are teachers, they're both teachers, I think high school teachers, they went there for 3 months. That's the maximum amount of time that you can go visit an EU country. Romania is in the European Union, and you can visit there for 3 months just on your American passport. Small technicality. In the EU, there are countries that belong to the Schengen Treaty, and that means that when you go from the Czech Republic to Poland, I don't even have to take my passport. The border now between most of the EU countries is like the border between here in Nebraska or here in Missouri or here in Colorado. There's a sign along the road that tells you you've changed countries, but that's it. You may see where the inspection booths and that sort of thing used to be, but those no longer exist. Not so in Romania, because Romania, even though they're members of the European Union, they have not elected to be in this Schengen Treaty, which is the reciprocity of your passports. So when you go into Romania, you'll have to present your passport. When you come back out to Hungary, which is the way I go in and out, you'll have to present your passport. Okay. I think what I want to do now is go through some slides, and I will explain as much as I can some of the aspects and some of the things about the slides. That's the church in what we call Golfava. When you travel around the Transylvania part of Romania, you'll see two names on virtually every city. You'll see the Romanian name on top in Romanian language, because that's the predominant language. That's the language that's legal. Hungarian is not illegal. Hungarian was illegal under Ceausescu, but it's no longer a problem. But villages will have two names. And if you know the Hungarian language, it's long, lots of letters. And Golfava is actually about the last little more than third of the full name for that church. But in that village, there's two names. The Germans were in Transylvania a lot going back a couple hundred years or something. They were called the, what'd they call them? Well, they didn't call them Germans. They were the, anyway, some of the towns, the bigger ones, like Brasov and Bucharesti, those will have three names. When you drive in it, you'll see three names. There's a name on top in Romanian, a name in Hungarian, and a name in German, because the Germans settled what still is the five largest cities there. That church, when I saw it first in 12, and I'm taking zero credit for this, I just happened to be a guy that was going. Our church has been sending them about $1,200 a year for several years. They have a couple of members of the congregation that have done extremely well in business ventures. The most recent one is a lady who started a bakery. And I've now seen that bakery every time that I've been there. Ann has visited the bakery, she has as many pictures from the bakery as I have in total, perhaps. That bakery is a contributor to the church. They give money to the church. One other digression. In Romania, when you're born a Unitarian, you're a Unitarian for life. I would say, to me, it's much like somebody who is Jewish. When you're born Jewish, you may not believe the faith, you may not go to the Jewish church, but you're Jewish your entire life. That's your birthright. And in Romania, somebody who's born into the Calvinist church or Catholic or Unitarian, they're that for life. It's like it's stenciled on their forehead. So it's, for me, it's a little bit different concept than here. That said, when you go to church, you find out that the total membership is probably four or more times the amount of people that show up. because those people who were born Unitarians are still Unitarians and come once in a while. Ann and I were there, the second Sunday we were there was Easter, and the church had the largest group of people that I've ever seen there for the Easter service. It was great. It was a great service. That church, I'll talk about fortified churches, because there's a lot of fortified churches. That wall that you see is sort of a fortified deal, but there are churches there that I've photographed, and I'll show you, that have big walls. But that wall had rusty metal on top of it when I first saw it in 12. The woodwork on the bell tower was old, rotten, falling apart. And on the far side of the church that we can't see, there was a crack that you could stick your hand in that went from the roof line down to the foundation. And if you went inside the church, you could see the crack there. Those things have been repaired. Our church went there in 91 and 94, and then nothing for 10 years. There were some people that went, but no official visits. And it seems to me that they like being recognized. They like it that some Americans have shown up and valued them enough to visit them. And that church looks immensely better now than what it did 5, 6, 7 years ago. And I think it'll continue to improve a little bit. Okay. This is the men's entrance. This is the east entrance to the church. You can see that retaining wall, that wall, the fortified wall, sort of barely to the right. You can get a little bit of the glimpse of the town. You see some people walking down there. That's the primary mode of transportation, is walking or a horse-drawn wagon. If somebody owns a tractor, it's not unusual to see mom and dad and a couple, three kids on the tractor riding in. This town is not big enough to have much in the way of a grocery store or any other kind of stores. And there is a village that's probably about 5 kilometers, 3 miles north of there. And you'll see people riding their tractor into town, because that's their means of transportation, is the tractor if they have it. Or you'll see them with a horse-drawn wagon. And you see them sometimes when it's raining and everybody's covered up a little bit. But that's the east side of the church. That's the door that the men come in. Everybody comes out the same door. Evidently, previous ministers have convinced the congregation that it's okay, and the only way that the minister can shake women's hands as well as men is if everybody comes out the same door. So that's the east door. I'll call it for the moment the men's entrance. This is inside of the wall, inside of the gate, and you're looking there at a side view of the women's entrance. That's the date of that congregation. That's not the date of the church, but that's the date, I understand it, of the beginning of that congregation. And the Unitarians are 450 years old, so they're not as old as the oldest Unitarians. This is a small town, real small village. And so it wouldn't have been a spot where somebody would have started a church. This is standing up in the minister's perch, the minister's podium, looking at the women's section. And up above, you'll see in the far corner up above, is the organ. And they have a music director. And the Unitarians there value music and the arts much like what we do here. And that's the women's section in church. This is the men's section. This is standing in the same spot looking the other way. The young man in the black sweater is Bela, and I can't tell you his last name because it's about, 15, 18 letters long, and there's two of them because they use routinely their mother's name and then theirs. And so Bela, B-E-L-A, I'm told that's the better pronunciation, but I think of him as something else. But Bela's his first name, and he's got the rest of his name. He's the minister. The man on the right is Arbert. Arbert is the president of the congregation. Arbert and I have had many conversations through Bela as the interpreter, because Arbert speaks no English. My smartphone now will let me dictate a message, and it'll translate it to Hungarian. And so sometimes he and I will talk that way. That's Bella in the minister's home, which I'll show you a picture of. The stole around his neck was made for him by our minister. And some of the pictures that are out in the vestibule shows Kendall, our minister, and me with that gift. For the people there, it's very important that a gift have some sort of meaning, have some sort of history. They don't want you to buy something at a store and give it to them. They like something that has been yours, something that you made, something that has some history to it. And so that's one of the gifts that we've given them. These shirts, Ann and I are wearing shirts. If you look out in the near your kitchen, you'll see a red shirt hanging up there. That's the shirt from 5 years ago. There's a small difference in addition to the color change. The line on that, well, as a matter of fact, if you look at that, you can see the name of the town. Look right under that, and you'll know that that's the name of the town. But that's the shirt from 5 years ago. There's also two shirts out there that are tan that just have the, what's the name of this?
Ouroboros.
Ouroboros. This is the circle of life. It's a real ancient symbol, goes back to the Egyptians, and it means various things in various cultures, but it's kind of a circle of life. And we took them some of these T-shirts, which Bella gave away, and then the brown T-shirts don't have any identification from the congregation on it. So I think those went to kids, and we took a dozen of those to go to the kids. But that's him displaying his new stole that Kendall made for him. That is the gift that the church made for them in 1991. This hangs in their congregation, in their church, and you can see there, September 1991. That was All Souls' first visit to the church. Hanging, see where the light is up there? That's the minister's podium, and I don't know, I think I may have another picture, but right below that you can see a piece of tapestry, and that is a piece of artwork out of cloth that was displayed in All Souls for many, many, many years. And when we went there in 2014, that was the gift that we took to them, was that piece of artwork, and it now hangs right there. This is Ann practicing preaching. Fortunately, the audience was very small, and so nobody was clapping. There you can see the artwork, and that's where the minister speaks. You'll notice, oh, thank you, I have a laser pointer. You can see the stove has the heat transfer in the exhaust pipe. These pictures were taken before Easter. This would have been, this is before Easter. This is the Sunday before Easter. This is a picture I took during church. And now we have moved to Easter. This is Easter Sunday. You can see the communion things set up there. Having been raised in a Baptist church, I know about communion. Spending years as a Presbyterian, I know about communion. But that's the first place that I've taken communion as a Unitarian. It's interesting, and I'm grinning, because one of the times that I was there in the past, and Bella knows me well. He knows my beliefs and lack of beliefs, and knows that I'm a pretty serious guy, and knows that I'm not a big fan of communion. I think it's, but he told me on the way to church when we were walking over, he said, "Ken, take communion." And I said, "Okay." And so I did, and it didn't hurt me. And so, Ann and I both took communion on Easter Sunday, and it was a neat service. It was as moving of a service as what I've experienced, so it was a great experience. This is him delivering his sermon. It's all in Hungarian. We don't have any ministers in the house, I hope. If you've ever been bored listening to a sermon, try sitting through a sermon in Hungarian where you don't understand anything. One of the techniques that you'll figure out, though, is when he's beginning to close. I don't know if you've spent much time listening to people speak in other languages, but I go to church in the Czech Republic when I'm there. There's a Unitarian congregation in Prague, and I go to that church. The flow of their service is exactly like ours and exactly like yours. They light the chalice. They have some greetings. They value music and so forth. But I listen to him give sermons in Czech, and I don't really understand hardly anything that he's... But the tempo almost always slows down. When a speaker is nearing the end, they slow down some and they get more serious. So that's how I know when he's almost done. This is the men's section on the left at Easter. The women's section back there, you'll notice, is much more crowded than what it was before. This is the outside of the church, starting to acquaint you a little bit with the street and the community that's there. And that brown house... See the brown house right at the left of the picture? That brown house is between the church, if you will, and that's the minister's house. It's not a huge place like that. The road falls down quickly, and so I'm looking uphill at that house. The lower portion of that next to us is a large meeting room that they use that for the congregation's meeting in the wintertime because... You notice perhaps the earlier service and the one that I'll show you the video of a little bit. People are in church at April wearing coats because it's not warm in there. And so they meet in that house. But that house has been painted and some repair work done on that in recent times, partly because of the money that we give. But I think our money has actually acted as a catalyst. I think the people there like it that somebody else is paying attention to them. And I think it's fostered the idea and the incentive for the people with a little bit of money to contribute to the church. This is up on the hill looking down at the village. That's the church. You can see this is very rolling countryside. If you're familiar with that part of the world, the Carpathian Mountains are all around. I think way more than half of Transylvania has the Carpathian Mountains that... dominate the landscape. Okay, you need to move your thinking now to a flea market. Only there it's not quite the caliber of a flea market. It's got merchandise, as you'll see, all over the map. You can buy almost anything that you want. This happens in the village north of Golfava every Wednesday, and you can buy shoes, you can buy... I don't know, flowers. You can buy pigs, okay? You can buy chickens. You can buy pigs in a crate. You can buy pigs, little pigs in a box. You can buy pigs in a truck. All of these pictures were taken, you know, within a minute of each other. And if you want some cows, you can buy some cows. Or if you have a hunger, I was going to string these pork sausages next to the hogs, but I thought I would not do that. But this is, eating is a big tradition there. I don't know if any of you know what palinka is, but if you go to Romania, to Transylvania, even for breakfast, if you're a guest in somebody's house, they're going to pull out the palinka. Palinka is plum brandy, but it's been distilled enough that there's not much brandy left. It's a pretty good grade of alcohol. And there's two octanes. There's one pass through the distill, and that's not too bad. The second pass is very tasty stuff that cleans out your sinuses instantly. If you need horse bridles, there's horse bridles. If you need other kind of tack, they even know about nice colors. All of this stuff was for sale. There's produce. Here's more produce for sale. And you can see the magnitude of this market. I get a kick out of it. This is a not unusual scene, but that is a Roma lady. There they're known as the gypsies. Socioeconomically, gypsies are the lowest on the socioeconomic rung there, and they are the people that everybody looks down on. They're the people that are mistreated to the extent that they can get by with. But very colorful dresses on people. Good-looking kids. It's really a shame. The little brown place there that you see to the left, that's the restaurant that we ate at several times. Ann can tell you about the broccoli soup. She had some broccoli soup that was emerald green. It was gorgeous stuff. And since then, she's tried to make some of that, and it didn't turn out quite as good. But this is eating. To some extent, eating is a serious business there. This is in that restaurant, and I kid you not, this was a working group somewhere. These guys came in, and I don't think anybody talked. They came in, sat down, and ate, and left. But this is moving now to some fortified churches. This is a model of fortified churches. During those ancient times, it was not a hospitable place to live. The Ottomans and a lot of these folks came through and they just killed everybody. And so that's a schematic of a fortified church. This is a map of various fortified churches in Transylvania. What the churches did was they built huge walls. And this is the largest fortified church in Romania. PJMER, however you pronounce that, Perzmir, is the name of this church. We got there about 5 minutes too late to go through this one, but we did go through Harman. This is in the same vicinity. This is near Brasov, which is in the eastern part of Transylvania. This is a fortified church. The portholes up there is places where they could pour hot oil out on anybody that was after them, and they could shoot bows and arrows through the portholes. This is inside of the wall. This is the church inside of the wall. And there is a view that shows you where the people lived. They just didn't go inside of the walls when the bad guys were around. They moved inside of the walls. And I've been in Prizmir on another visit, and there's three layers. There's three elevations of apartments inside of that wall all the way around. So I don't know how many hundreds of people could live in there, but that's inside. This is inside of the church, and this is the pews, I guess, if you didn't have the money to buy a better pew or something. This is another church closer to our partner church. I just took a picture of the outside of it, but it's another fortified church. Out on the table, there's a bunch of pictures and things, and you'll see one of them is a picture of Baratan. Baratan is one of the most picturesque fortified churches there. Several hundred years ago, the Romanian government the Hungarian government at that point, they weren't keen on churches lasting too long. And so the rule was that you couldn't build a church out of stone or mortar or bricks. You had to build a church out of wood because they didn't want them to last. Well, the people up there learned how to make very steep steeples, wooden shingles. And so these churches are highly decorated inside with paintings and that sort of thing. And in the northern part, Metamoris, part of Romania is a region that has, I don't know, 30 or 40 of these churches with extremely steep steeples, and they're all made out of wood, and they've all lasted extremely well. This is going up in the Ferragus part of the Carpathian Mountains. That is a road you see in a distance. That is a road that you see up closer. If you're going up to the mountain pass, you'll twist and turn. And do you know what that is? If you own some sheep, and I own some sheep, and a couple of other people own some sheep, we probably would hire a shepherd to take care of them. And they open range graze sheep all over the country. You see very few fences there. And there will be probably with a group that big, there's at least two shepherds and probably three or four dogs. But typically you'll see one shepherd and a couple of dogs. And you see free-range sheep all over the country. But that's in the Carpathian Mountains. And I haven't counted them, but that would be several hundred sheep. That was shot with a telephoto lens across the valley. This is now in Abiula. That is a historical city in the western part of Transylvania. This is where John Sigmund, if you look at the lower left-hand side, that's in English, John Sigmund, he was the first prince of Transylvania, because when he was the ruler, he was known as the prince. And that is where he is theoretically buried. And this is Queen Isabella, the lowest one on the left there. This is where his mother is also interned. And so we went to that town, Albula, and saw, and this is where, if you will, we began. This is where John Sigmund said to Francis David, you know, do that Diet of Torta. And so that's where Unitarians began. The lady on the left is the baker lady. The guy to Anne's left is the husband and a couple of kids. They have two kids. And the minister, Bella, is in the background. And one other quickie, and I'll run it out of time. While we were there, I'll skip ahead and come back. This lady came to, this is Suzanne in a different spelling. And what she brought with her were these pictures. The gray-haired lady is Karen Wynn, who is a member of our congregation. She was over there in 94, and this lady has kept those pictures, brought them over to Bella's house to show us, and said, tell her I said hi. And so I took pictures of her pictures and brought them back. But that's the way those people appreciate us being there. We're going to go to church now for just a little bit, maybe a couple of minutes. I don't want to be... Do you start that, Doug? Oh, all right. Can we hear the bell?
I have to start the video.
Okay, go ahead. There's a bell ringing because they have a bell ringer. The men, you'll notice, are coming in the east door. And the ladies are now coming in the south door. And that's the beginning of the Palm Sunday. And I didn't want to be running around with my camera, so I just set it up with it running. And it ran for 29 minutes and about 5 seconds, I think, until it ran out of power, and then that was all I took. I cut out a whole bunch of stuff that was totally disinteresting. The minister stands outside and welcomes all the men until it's time to start church. And then he comes in and he sits in that far little place. And they sing a couple songs. I'm going to let you hear one of their songs. They're excellent on their music. Okay, Doug, that's enough. Thank you all. We have some time, I think, for discussion. We do that now or a little bit later? Now? Okay, questions? Yes, sir. Yes, yes.
Roger. Roger. Roger.
What percentage of Transylvania, roughly, is in Romania, and what percentage is in Hungary? And do I understand correctly that the language spoken in Transylvania is generally Hungarian?
Yes, the language that's spoken in Transylvania, I think in total, is something well over 50% Hungarian language. In that village, everybody is Hungarian, so it varies. I went to a little celebration that was in the city next to them, and they were giving away Romanian flags, and I've got the little Romanian flag, and I walked into the place, and I just tested my English on this woman, and she spoke English, and I don't remember the whole conversation, but I said something about where I was visiting, and she kind of frowned. Oh, Hungarians. I mean, she knew the village and knew that they were Hungarians, and it was, you know, kind of like, she wasn't happy about it. You had another part of your question that I didn't catch, the beginning.
It was roughly how much of Transylvania is in Romania and how much is in Hungary?
I think, don't quote me, but I think all of Transylvania now is in Romania. There's a lot of Unitarians in Hungary, but they're in Hungary, not in Romania. Yes, ma'am.
I'm Barbara Bascom, and most of you know we lived in Romania for about 10 years. Can you hear me? Yeah. So really enjoyed your presentation. We've been to that church. I think that most people, when they think of Romania, they think of Transylvania, which is just one state of Romania, and we didn't live in Transylvania. But it's the only place that you're going to find the Unitarian Universalist Church, because it's not the state church, and it's interesting because the last time I talked to them there, they said that every Unitarian church who makes trips abroad wants to go to this one church. So they're much visited by Unitarian congregations like this one who travel. But it's a very interesting thing, and you can visit the place where the government of Romania recognized the church, not just the Unitarian Church, but all churches. I can't remember what year, but several hundred years ago. And that's a big holiday in Romania because the governments of most of the Eastern European countries did not recognize anything other than the other church, one church.
Okay, thank you. This lady over here.
I had the chance to go to the Pentecostal church right down the road there, and as far as I could gather, they don't believe in the Trinity, and they believe that God is a man or something. That's what I got. So I was interested. There was the one church that had a crucifixion. And there was one church photograph that you showed that had a crucifixion. The crucifix, the thing scares the hell out of me. But, you know, the dead guy who's all, like, starving and stuff like that. I don't know if that was an adoption or a different church or they were hanging out there. But when you mentioned, what is that, whose body are they eating when they do the communion?
John Sigmund.
So it's Jesus' body. So communion is Christian there.
Well, they pray, they read the Bible in their services, and they have prayer. So I say this, that they practice Christianity a little bit stronger than we do. Ann, do you want?
Is it working? That large church was not a Unitarian church. I don't know if it was Catholic or what would it have been?
Catholic or Calvinist, I think, or maybe Lutheran.
But the people over there that we visit are not Unitarian Universalists. They are Unitarians. So they don't have that much of a freedom of belief. They do believe in God. They just don't believe in the Trinity. They don't believe that Jesus was a deity. So that's the biggest difference.
Cool. Somebody over.
Sabrina Booker, first off, sorry for me stepping out. The downside of eating plants is you got to eat more. This is more of a theological question. Okay, so they don't believe in the Trinity. Now, I don't see the point of a Trinity either because, okay, he's baptized. There's the Holy Ghost. Somebody up top is talking. Where did he get the Trinity from? There's an theologian I know about that. How can they be the same person? Is there someone coming down, someone talking on the upside while Jesus is sitting there? That's a theological question. I have no idea. If anybody knows, let me know.
Did you?
The theology? The question was? Well, I think it's the Trinity, right?
Yeah.
So I had the same sort of question. If they're doing communion, that's a symbolism of the Trinity.
Well, they weren't doing a communion relative to the Trinity. Go on.
Maybe it'll break it up.
Here. I didn't understand the communion since it was in Hungarian, but they worship God. And I'm assuming that the wine is Jesus' blood and the bread is Jesus' body.
I forgot to tell you, we were so busy talking about my German maiden name, but my father was born in Austria-Hungary, and he served in the Austrian army in the First World War when he was drafted when he was 16, and then it became Romania. So when he left Romania, when he was 20 years old, it was Romania then, and the town was Drochenitz, a suburb of Czernowitz, and my grandmother was killed in the Holocaust of the Second World War.
The lady over here.
Kind of, yeah. Sorry. One of our convener here. Okay.
And are we?
Well, I feel like we need a lesson in theology about communion. If you're a Catholic, you believe in transubstantiation, that the body and blood, or that the wine and bread becomes the body and blood of Christ. If you're a Lutheran, you believe in consubstantiation, which means that it is the blood and wine at the same time. It is the bread and body at the same time. However, if you grew up in a liberal Protestant church, as I did, you don't believe any of that stuff. You believe that Jesus asked you to drink bread or to drink wine and eat bread to remember him.
Yeah.
It says, this do in remembrance of me. It's a purely symbolic thing, and you're not eating Jesus' body.
Thank you.
Am I done, Doug? One more.
One, okay. One more question, and it's Sylvia.
Oh, I'm Sylvia Beeman, but I did grow up in a Unitarian church, which did vote to be a Unitarian Universalist, one of two very large Unitarian churches in Cincinnati, Ohio. And we did have communion, but it would only be at night, and only some people came, which my family did. And the minister said, drink this in remembrance of Jesus, who was seen as a great teacher, and eat this bread in remembrance of Jesus. And I don't know, it was kind of nice.
Thank you. Thank you all much for your attention. I think I'm done now. Am I supposed to just be quiet, Ms. Convener? Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. That was most interesting. We have a closing hymn, which is number 1017 in the Teal Book. We are building a new way. And I would remind you, when you're finished, after a few closing words, take the hymn books back and put them back where you got them. Francis David, who was the spiritual advisor to King Sigismund, put love at the center of religious faith. He said, "You need not think alike to love alike. Love is the spirit of this fellowship. May the songs we sing celebrate this love. May the lives we lead embody this spirit, and may you all go forth in peace." Thank you. Yep, blow it out.